it's about like being comfortable with like average.
Yes.
You know, like being comfortable with that. And obviously, even as an investor, you know, and which I think was one of the early thoughts around when we came up with that term. But, you know, if you're an average investor, like you're crushing it. You know what I mean? And there's value in that. You don't always have to find yourself in a position where you are chasing greater gains or above average, because there's a cost to doing that. You're accepting more risk. You are likely putting yourself in a position where you need to gain a greater level of expertise, which you may not have the comfort, the willingness, or the time, or even the resources to develop. That may lead to a whole bunch of frustration and so on and so on. So just like be comfortable with being rich and regular. Yes. You are comfortable with your investing strategy. It does not require a lot of time or thought. It puts you in a position where you are immune, if you will, to the flood of media and hype beasts that go out there, which leads to a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. All of those things, I think, are the benefits to like sort of being simple and leading your life that way. And the last thing I'll say is overall, I had this conversation with a couple of people already, but overall, I would love to see and push for a collective lowering of the bar. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. And today we're talking about what we not gonna do.
Okay. Welcome to February, everyone. Happy Black History Month. Happy early Valentine's Day. And happy what? The hell happened in January?
Yeah, right.
Like it was just
it flew by.
New Year's,
yeah,
and here we are in February.
Yeah,
so
that's
welcome.
What surge will do you?
My goodness.
Yeah, no. All right. Well, in all seriousness, today's topic is about five financial don'ts. And the reason I chose this is because I'm always one for contrasting topics. And since last week we talked about these small habits that lead to good results, I figured this week we could do a hard 360, keep people on their toes, and talk about some don'ts.
Yeah, let's do it. You know, and that's comforting because there's always like five top things to do.
I know.
10 things to do.
January is all about things you should be doing.
Yeah.
And it's like, by the time you hit February, you're like, you know what? Let me tell you what I'm not going to do.
Yeah. Okay. And I get that all the time. So from you, what I'm not going to do. I'm like, okay, well, we're going to share this.
No, mine is a we when it comes to you, what we not going to do.
Oh, okay. You just assume
yeah,
my
universal
power.
Universal we.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So consider this my or our disclaimer. This is a bit of a heads up to some of our listeners. Obviously, you're allowed to disagree. You are allowed to say, you know what? I am going to do that. Totally fine. We're not telling you, well, we are telling you what not to do. But the reality is, or the point I'm trying to make is that there are obviously exceptions to the rules. Obviously, you want to apply some of these things where it makes sense to you. And so, yeah, with that said, why don't we go ahead and dive in?
Yeah, I just want to piggyback because I always like to say that there aren't that many rules in personal finance in general that people all agree on or that are all applicable across all income levels, all demographics, and just personal preferences. I remember Dr. Phil used to say, there's two sides to every pancake. And at the time, like 9-year-old me thought that was just the most brilliant philosophical insight. There's two sides to every pancake. And even the stuff that seems pretty straightforward is always going to have people arguing both sides. And we see it all the time in like Facebook groups or personal finance groups. Someone might ask an instant question like, should I buy a new car or a used car? And there will be 450 answers. People are all very convicted and have strong opinions.
Yeah.
But half of the answers are always going to say, buy used, cars are depreciating assets. And the other half is going to say, buy new, you'll save on maintenance in the long term. It's always just going to be, you know, two sides.
Yeah, rules of thumb are without question some of my least favorite sort of components or aspects of the personal finance media space that we're in. Because to your point, there are just so many of them. And I think on top of that, it seems as if like a lot of the more vocal people, instead of, let's say, appreciating more nuance. It's like, no, discard that rule of thumb.
Oh, yeah, they
and accept
down.
My rule of thumb right. or this rule of thumb. And I'm like, well, you know, it is what it is. Like, you're just sort of fighting fire with fire or one hot take with a new hotter take. Right. And, you know, I'm a little wiser these days. We're going to talk about wisdom in a future episode. So I'm sort of projecting here. But I am a lot wiser. Maybe I'm stepping into my silver-haired period of life. But, you know, I just have a much greater appreciation for finding balance. And, you know, to that point, there are consequences or challenges to that as well. And this makes me think about when we were writing our book, our publisher, or our editor, I should say, at our publisher, was pushing back on our manuscript and saying, you know, we were kind of hedging a little bit, that we were, I think the specific words that she was saying was we were undermining our authority, because we right. would make a point, but then we would also make the point to round it out and say, but if yeah. this happens or that happens, because again, we understand that, you know, life happens, things happen. I don't want to tell you to do X absolutely without factoring in that, you know what, someone may not even be in a position to do that, exactly. or that may not even be
but they don't live in an area
applicable.
Where that makes sense.
Correct. Yeah, and exactly. so, you know, it is a delicate balance to be struck there. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about that in this particular podcast episode. In our book, we talk about it by sort of separating the advice or the counsel in two categories. The first is what we call rules, which are the evergreen hills that we are absolutely willing to die on. This is advice that we believe is going to live on for the long term. Does not matter at what point, obviously, you know. And I'm already hedging, but it's like 50 years from now, I don't know what's going to happen. But the point
is, believe today that
this
things
will
are
stand
be,
yeah. the test of time for so long as many of our readers and listeners are alive. I'm comfortable saying that.
Gosh.
And then there are rituals, which you can kind of consider as advice that you would get from your best friend, right? Mm-hmm. Someone that's saying, listen, man, this is what I went through. This is what this group of people are going through. And so it's a little bit more flexible.
Yeah. Yeah, these don'ts that we're about to cover are more like rituals.
Yeah.
They're not hills that we're willing to die on. They're meant to be revisited over time because the reality is we've done all these things before. They're not like these cardinal sins. They're just things that we've learned over the years that don't have as big of a payoff as people think.
Yeah.
But we had to try them first to know that they didn't work, which is one of those paradoxes about personal finance. It's kind of like the paradox about the glass ceiling, which, you know, is what they use to refer to the barriers in a professional yeah. sense. But by definition, you can't see a glass ceiling until you hit it.
Exactly.
Like, it's hidden. And the same is true for personal finance. Sometimes you don't know what not to do until you do it, and then it doesn't get the result that you want.
Yeah, yeah. I love it. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and get started? Why don't you kick us off with the first don't?
Okay, our first don't is, drumroll please, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and leave a review while you're there. For those who listen all the way to the end of every episode, you actually get to hear me creatively pitch you for reviews and ratings at the very end. But this time we wanted to bring it up to the top because ratings and reviews are so important for keeping podcasts like this alive and yep. relevant. And if this podcast has been helpful to you in any way and you'd like it to continue and you'd like other people to be helped by it, leaving a rating and review is just one small thing that you can do to put out the good sense and grace that you want to see in the world. So that's our first don't. I promise all of them are not going to be shameless plugs. That would be funny if like all of them were like, don't forget to tell me I'm pretty today.
Yeah. Let's not do that.
All right. So the second don't is actually borrowed from my good friend in my head, Mr. Spike Lee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're besties.
Spike.
And it's don't believe the hype. And what I mean by hype is these over-the-top takes. It's kind of like the take-on-take battle you referred to at the top of the episode.
Yeah.
But whether it's good news or bad news, financial hype is ultimately a distraction because it usually lacks perspective.
Yep.
Because if it had perspective, it wouldn't be hype, right? So a couple of examples where I see this playing out online is when people share super early results as if they're indicative of future success.
Right.
So to be clear, there's nothing wrong with celebrating early gains or sharing the momentum you're having in an asset class or whatever it is. But without the perspective that says, hey, y'all, it's only been 3 days, but I'm very happy so far, Or, you know, I'm super excited to say that my account balance has grown 300%. But when I look at the historical trends, it looks like this is fairly normal and I just happen to buy at the right time.
Yeah.
I know one of those messages is more sexy than the other one. Like the algorithm typically doesn't reward people who add that layer of perspective. But as a reader, as a listener, as a consumer of content, you can go a bit deeper and start to look for it.
Yeah. So a couple of things. As a fan of hip hop and as a son of the golden era of music, born in Brooklyn, New York, Don't Believe the Hype is actually Public Enemy, not Spike Lee. But I understand why you would make the correlation. But I just think that, you know, for the listeners out there who
I think I was thinking
Do the Right Thing, and because they play Public Enemy.
Well, they're kind of related.
They're certainly related.
I feel like I lost some points in my cool card. You definitely
did. You definitely did. I think we might get a couple two-star reviews.
Maybe I should say,
I was about to rate it.
I was about to leave a review.
Yeah.
April Fool's in February.
And not that I want to put images of Flavor Flav in anybody's head right now, but now that that's there, I think that the point is around hype, and since Flavor Flav is the preeminent hype man, you know, I kind of go back to like the financial media. And again, we talk about this in our book, that there's just so much of it right now. And I think that's why it is a bit of a recurring theme. And so it's worthy of mentioning, like, the media's job. And by media, I mean magazines, articles, online platforms, all of us. We are part of the media, all of it. Our job is to grab your attention at all costs. And that means that when the market is down, even if it's just like 3%, 5%, and again, that might hurt more for some people than others, but like, it is their job to hit you with that hard-hitting, eye-catching headline, like the Dow Jones tumbles 1,000 points from its record high, or stocks take a hit, or it's a bloodbath, and you're looking on the screen, and it's just like, you know, fast-paced moving line charts, and it's just like one of the scariest things in the world to see, where you're looking at people, and they're just like frustrated, and what do you think? What's happening? And it's like, dude, the world is not falling
it's
apart.
Chicken Little, this guy is falling.
Absolutely is. But it works.
It does.
And this is why they do it. It keeps your attention right after the break. They want you to stay there to see what this next expert has to say. And the process just repeats itself. And so I'm not saying ignore it completely. Maybe you're part of a forum or you've seen someone say, we ignore it. But, you know, like, whatever, like, just shy of ignoring it is, like, you can be mindful of it, but you don't necessarily need to react to it. And if you're looking for sort of an immediate tactic to respond to whenever someone is saying something like that, I think one of the best pieces of advice that we give and have also heard is just zoom out a little bit, right? Zoom out. Look at what that stock or that fund or what the market is doing over a longer period of time. Don't obsess over what may have happened yesterday or over last week. Like, zoom out. That's how bears are defined, right? Zoom out. Is this something that is happening over a longer stretch of time? And at that point, even then, the response isn't necessarily to overreact. It's really just to reassess, rebalance, maybe revisit your investing strategy, figure out what you need to do in order to get over that bumpy period. But if you ever find yourself sort of, you know, being bombarded with that, there's a pretty good chance that you are a part of what we're going to call like an algorithmic hype cycle.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's like going back to what we were saying, like, this is what it looks like online. If you click on that thing, you read that thing, these algorithms are smart enough to say, hey, you must like this. You must want more of this. And then all of a sudden, it's like fear. It's crashing, it's tumbling.
Or outlier results.
Absolutely.
Wild success.
It happens on both sides of the spectrum. So to your point, one minute they're going to feed you full of fear. The next minute it's going to be like, this is what success looks like. And if you're not in the multiples of millions of dollars, you're not successful. Click here and I'll tell you how you can be.
Right. Yeah. So I totally agree. One of the ways that you know that you're in sort of these hype cycles is when the news that you're seeing far surpasses the statistical averages for things that are actually happening. So one example is, let's say, 401k balances. We know that the average 401k balance for someone who's in their mid to late 40s or 30s is about $72,000. And if you control for income inequality and look at the median, it's even lower at $26,000. So most people who are, you know, mid-30s, early 40s, have about $26,000 saved in their retirement. But if all you see on Twitter are 28-year-olds who have seven-figure businesses or 32-year-olds that are multimillionaires,
right.
you might be in an algorithmic hype cycle. There's a chance that you may have surrounded yourself by accounts that are skewing your perspective on reality and causing you to question what's worthy of attention or not. If I come through and say, hey, I made, you know, $40,000 in compound interest last year, you might dismiss my article, my podcast, because you now have this layer that tells you that only the millions are important.
Right.
But the algorithms are going to do what they do, right? The powers that be have already decided that this is what works. Research has proven that this is what works. So the only way to control it is exactly what you said earlier, which is to not click on that content. Don't click on it. Don't retweet it. Even if your retweet is one of those quote tweets where you're critical, it still counts as something as you shared. You can also choose to soft unfollow or mute certain accounts that are notorious for hypebeasting and oversimplifying, or even just mute key terms. Another thing that I think is important is knowing how to spot hype. So one clear way to recognize hype when it's happening is to look for superlatives.
Yeah.
So hypebeast usually always loves superlatives in the extreme realms. So things like best, worst, biggest, fastest. So like all the things you would hear on like a car commercial, right? And I found that the antidote to cut through the hype is to put their take in context and ask them, compared to what?
Right.
So if you hear somebody say something is the best way to do anything, make sure you ask them, compared to what? If you're reading an article that says this is the fastest way or the hottest new anything, look in the article to see if the journalist actually compared it to something else.
Yep.
If they didn't, you know that the framing is likely skewed towards whatever they're saying is the best or the worst of something.
Yeah, and if all else fails, you know, just remember that, like, if it sounds too good to be true, then it most likely is, or at a minimum is not repeatable for you and most people. I remember a few years ago, we were actually featured in a CNBC article, and we were like, oh, wow, it's really cool. It was an interesting period of time where, like, we'd spoken to a journalist, and they turned that conversation into about three different articles, and we were loving it. It was all this different press and eyeballs, and they posted the article on social media, and I think the headline was something to the effect of, like, this couple tripled their salary in 10 years or something like that, and someone responded, like, I don't see what the big deal is. That's pretty normal to me, and I was like, wow, like, you might actually be, like, you're in an extreme world, right? Like
tripling felt extreme to me at that time.
Tripling felt extreme. And it was interesting because I understand, like, at the moment in time we were going through it, it was a huge accomplishment. I understand this person's perspective because we're at a different point in our lives and our careers. We're just like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, well, 10 years is a long period of time. But it took us a while to get here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And now tripling your income overnight is the new norm on social media. With like there are people who are like, I got a new job and I make 400% more.
Exactly.
And as of yesterday.
To your point. Like,
it didn't take 10 years anymore.
We're knowing more and more people because of remote jobs that are able to double their income in a single year. To your point, triple. I know people who have three jobs, three like high paying jobs, they're making what the old CEO used to make because, you know, they're able to manage all of their jobs working at home. Right. And so we're living in a completely different period of time that has never occurred before. And so all of that to say, be mindful of those things compared to what? Compared to pre-pandemic,
right?
Compared to a world where those things literally weren't possible. So just make sure that you're sort of factoring in all of these things before you fall into the hype.
Yes. All right. Hit us with the third don't.
Okay. So the third don't is don't forget taxes. And I'm saying this as I'm also
like, you sounded so sad.
I did, because that was like a sigh of admission. Like, if ever I had an entrepreneurial kryptonite, and again, given when we are recording this particular episode, we're like in the thick of tax season, and I know exactly what I need to do to provide it to provide all the information to our CPA, but I'm literally doing what I've done over the last 2 years, which is I get ahead of it, and I set the date to say, this is the day I'm just going to dive in. And then that date comes, and I just move it. I'm like, I can't do this. I cannot do this right now.
Yeah.
Let's just move it out. But I was like, but I'm not going to move it all the way. I was going to move it to Wednesday. Then Wednesday hits and something else happens. Like, I'm emotionally definitely not doing it today. I don't know what I was thinking. You move it to the next period. And then before you know it, I'm filing for an extension.
Yes. So don't do that.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Don't be like me.
And I'm not going to go on another rant about taxes, but we did offer a few tips on last week's episode about some small habits that can help you create a system around organizing your taxes. But y'all, please don't forget to do them.
Yeah.
Why? Because your best case scenario is that you get hit with a penalty. But the worst case scenario is that you go to jail. Okay?
That
Uncle
happens.
Sam does not play. But the silver lining here is that the IRS audit rate actually seems to be trending down. So last year they audited less than 1% of returns. The bad news is that your chances of being audited actually escalate depending on various factors like the complexity of your return, the amount of deductions, and any other tax breaks, or like whether you're a business owner. There's a number of different factors that could actually increase your likelihood to get audited.
Yes. So Kiplinger just published a list of 23 IRS red flags. We'll link to this in the show notes as well. But these are all some of the red flags that will increase your chance of getting audited. Again, even though the IRS is auditing fewer and fewer returns these days, you don't want to be one of the few. So there are 23 of these red flags that Kiplinger has outlined. I'm just going to list a couple of them that certainly resonated with me, but I know may have also resonated with a few of our listeners. So the first one is claiming rental property losses. And I got to tell you, back when we were real estate investors, like, this to me was a huge draw and one of the reasons why I loved real estate, because it was almost impossible to not find some type of financial benefit. But if I'm looking directly at the article, and I'll just quote here, it says, first, if you actively participate in the renting of your property, you can deduct up to $25,000 of losses against your other income. We have certainly done this. I don't know that we've ever deducted up to $25,000, but we've certainly taken advantage of this tax benefit. This $25,000 allowance actually phases out, though, as your adjusted gross income exceeds $100,000, and it disappears completely after your adjusted gross income reaches $150,000. So as much as that is a benefit, if you are a property owner, you probably already know this. If you are a prospective real estate investor, while you might be intrigued by the idea that you can claim losses, just know that there are limits to it. And if you do that, you are sending a love letter, an invitation to the IRS and say, interesting. What's happening over here? Okay, the second one I actually find a bit hilarious, but it is claiming 100% business use of a vehicle. And I'm calling this out specifically because over the last year, I have seen more and more people excited about the possibilities and very much looking forward to buying, what is it, a Tesla Model X?
Oh, the G-Wagon. And any the Mercedes truck over 6,000 pounds.
Yeah. So
the internet found a loophole.
The internet found a loophole.
Hyped it up.
And said, hey, did you know that if you're a business owner, you can buy a Tesla and a Mercedes, and as long as it's a business vehicle, you can write it off 100%. It's like driving a luxury vehicle for free. While, and I'm using air quotes here, true, there are certainly, it's a lot more complicated than just going out and buying a car because you just spent $100 to get an LLC and then all of a sudden you think you can go out and buy a luxury vehicle. It is not that simple. You do need to speak to a licensed CPA to make sure that you're doing this and tracking your mileage and whatever sort of tactic that you want to use to ensure that you don't, that you're not breaking any laws, but also to make sure that you can actually take advantage of that deduction. But we're mentioning it because even if you do all of that, you are sending a red flag to the IRS. So even if it is legit, you are letting them know that, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. That Joe,
put it in the possible audit file.
Joe, the medical billing specialist, just happens to be an owner of a brand new shiny Mercedes G-Wagon, because now he's, which leads me to my third red flag, trading online. So this is the third red flag, claiming day trading losses. Again, I'm confident that if you spent even 10 minutes on the internet, you've been hit or you've been bombarded by some hype beast out there who was talking about these things. And we're not trying to throw shade to anyone out there, but we're just sort of giving you the other perspective here. So yes, is it true that you can claim day trading losses? I'm using air quotes here. Yes, but you are also, if you do that, sending a huge red flag to the IRS to say, let's explore what's going on at this person's house or in this person's business and so on. So do the hard work. And again, if you aren't comfortable, if you're not an expert in taxes, we aren't, which is why we hire and pay for a CPA to do it for us.
Yes. Yeah, it's a really good article. I strongly suggest you visit the show notes and read it. Because there are other red flags, like not claiming all of your taxable income. So a lot of people picked up side hustles that have gone kind of under the radar. Listen, and, you know, the government went after these kind of payment processing apps first. You get paid
through Cash App.
Yeah. So they went after them first because it's easier to just like send 1099s through, you know, those apps. But even if you have, you know, spent or invested far more income than your W-2 shows that you earned, it's a red flag. So just be careful. Don't forget your taxes and then go read that article.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say about that is taxes are one of those things, especially if you ever get audited, that can discourage you from entrepreneurship as a whole.
Right.
Right. And that's why I'm not exactly sure what your motivations are, but that's one of the things that I think is really important. I know plenty of people who are just discarded real estate investing as a whole because they got into a bad or messy tax situation. And as a result, they just avoid it altogether. Don't let that happen to you and don't let that be a reason for it. You can solve for all of that by paying a couple hundred dollars to a licensed CPA and letting them tell you the full truth, what's applicable to you, and then also giving you strategies that are likely for you to actually take advantage of while also minimizing the likelihood that you get audited.
Yes. All right, we've tackled our first three don'ts. We've got two more coming at you right after the break. All right, our fourth don't is don't spend all your cash.
Yeah.
And this is a controversial one, quite possibly one of my most controversial takes of 2022.
It ain't been that long.
Look at me violating one of the don'ts and hyping my own content. But seriously, the dialogue around cash typically falls into two categories. There's like the cash is king people, and then there's the cash is trash people. And the answer, like with most things, is somewhere in the middle, which is why we settled on the language of don't spend all your cash.
Yeah.
Because we've been on both sides of this. Like back when we were gainfully employed, W-2 employees, getting checks every other week, we certainly kept very little cash on hand outside of our emergency fund. We took pay yourself first very literally. And as soon as paychecks came in, we would automatically send it wherever we wanted it to go.
Sure did.
Because we believed that money just sitting in the checking account wasn't doing us any good. It was losing money, so to speak. But on the flip side, when we quit our jobs and liquidated our real estate, there were these moments where we had a ton of cash on hand. We would have something like 6 months of living expenses, an emergency fund, and just all kinds of like business cash. Just because we had less information, we didn't know what kind of income to expect from our business or how long the pandemic would last. You know, there was a minute there we thought it would be 3 weeks and we just didn't know. So we were far more conservative with our cash. Now that we have a couple of years of entrepreneurship under our belt, we understand how to build the right buffer between income and expenses and investing, right? And it's somewhere, again, in the middle. And we recognize that it changes seasonally to reflect the nature of our earning and spending. There are some seasons where I know that I'm more comfortable sending cash as soon as it comes in because we got time to make up for it. And then there are other seasons where it's like, depending on the business environment and just our energy levels, we might want to keep more cash on hand because we might not feel like working as hard kind of thing.
Yeah. And obviously, as entrepreneurs, like that is a part of the transition, you know, transitioning from W to employment where you've got a pretty consistent understanding of what's coming in every 2 weeks or every month or however frequently you're being paid. As an entrepreneur, you may not necessarily have that kind of flow depending on the point where you are in your journey. If you're paying yourself, if you're paying yourself on a regular basis or something like that. But, you know, even when I think about cash, like it's funny, the very first thought that comes to mind is the gift that your father gave our son when, I think it was when he was born or when he was one, it was a $100 bill. So Kirsten's father gave him a framed $100 bill And I think he carved, it's like in wood and glass.
Yeah, he wrote
or
a note on
and
it.
He wrote a note
it's
on
very
it.
Very sentimental.
And every, I think inflation. Every time I see it, I'm like, you could have just put no. I'm like, man, if you don't, I think I'm going to take
you
it.
You want to frame a receipt?
I'm going to make a copy of it, like a high quality copy of it, frame it, maybe put a note inside and say, this isn't real. We actually invested it, son. So the day that he breaks into it to buy like bubble gum or something.
You don't get our son arrested for using counterfeit.
Oh, you're right.
Money.
That might happen. Well, then we'll just put something funny on it. But that's, anyway, that's, you know, it just makes me think about, you know, the notion that so many people are taught to, like, any amount of cash that you see, it's almost like you're looking at money sort of being lost in that moment. Now, having said that, you know, there's a lot of value in having cash on hand, or at least just having cash readily available. And so when people say things like buy the dip, well, I mean, you need cash to actually do that.
Right.
You have to have cash on hand. If you've accounted for every single dollar and everything has been sent to automated, right, that there's no wiggle room, well, then you're not even going to be able to take advantage of opportunities like that. But the point is, like, you just don't want to fall into the trap of being so lean with your cash that you can't react to an opportunity or an emergency when it presents itself. I mean, just the other day, you know, we invested some money into two of our brokerage accounts, and I was reminded of how slow even that process was. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, man, market's down 7-10%. Let's go ahead and make that transfer. I was like, oh, gosh, I forgot. It's a 24-hour period for this firm, this other firm. They take what almost feels like 2 days to actually make that transfer happen. It's like, ah, you can't even actually take advantage of it, which, again, you might find yourself in a position where it's like, should I just leave cash even sitting in a brokerage account, which is why you tend to have that line item for cash on hand, how much your purchasing power is in that particular moment. So all of those, like, investment opportunities, emergencies, whatever it is, like, there's value in having cash on hand. You don't always have to invest in it, or you don't always have to sort of put every single dollar to work. If that's what works for you, that's fine. But for some of you, don't beat yourself up if you've got $500 or a couple hundred dollars, however much amount, sitting, what's the word, dormant in a checking or a brokerage account.
Yes. And that is not to say that we think you should try to time the market. Like, please don't hear that message as trying to time the market, which is actually a great parlay into the last, but certainly not least don't, which is don't try to be an expert. The siren song to be a financial expert is so strong, y'all. Yeah. Everybody wants to believe that they're the best at picking stocks and buying dips or taking risk, but the reality is none of us are. Nobody can predict markets. There are a few of us who can make educated guesses, and occasionally we swing big and hit a home run.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't make, you know what I mean. It's a mixed metaphor, right. But like.
you swing.
I know, but I don't know why I said educated guesses. I feel like there's a baseball version, like what happens before you swing big.
I can make that work, actually.
I don't know. Okay.
Well, I won't explain it to you, but it works.
All right. Whatever. Don't try to be an expert.
No, I think, you know, I think you're right. There is a tendency for a lot of people to assume that expertise is like required to get started or required for you to achieve some of these great results that you may have seen on the internet or read on social media. And as far as we're concerned, you know, I understand why even we may be lumped into that category of financial experts, but it's never been a label that I've worn comfortably, because money is such a large and ever-changing topic or world in and of itself. And I don't really feel like that term is warranted, but, you know, we certainly have expertise in some areas, but not in every single financial area. And I think when most people who may be newbies, or even like if they're pretty experienced, there's still this like tendency to assume that expertise is absolutely a requirement. And if you don't have that, then you will never achieve some of these really lofty financial goals or ambitions. And that's just absolutely not true. I think one of the things I would definitely recommend you do is if you have a favorite guru, it could even be us, anyone that you follow, that you sort of put on a pedestal, I want you to go to the earliest work. Like, take a couple minutes and just keep scrolling, keep digging, keep going back. Page 10 of Google, and read those articles, listen to those podcast interviews, and then I think you'll get a greater appreciation for what an expert is, but...
And how you become one.
How you become one, or even where you are, right? Because you may find yourself that you are comparing your year two to that person's year 10.
Right.
Right? You love what they're doing.
Or your couple hours a week to that person's 30 hours a week.
Full-time job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is what they do. So, of course, they're going to get very different results than what you may be able to get. And I think that's a really interesting tip. I tend to really enjoy those interviews because it gives me perspective like on where we may even be on our own journey. But I would highly recommend you do that because I think it helps to take the luster off of the term and mm-hmm. makes people a little bit more comfortable believing in themselves and finding that inner self-esteem to take action when needed.
Yes, I love that. And I know what some of the listeners are probably thinking, like, well, Kirsten, well, Julian, y'all don't sound like that, but you might be asking yourself, if I'm not going to be an expert, then what can I be? And, you know, thank you for asking, because we've compiled a short list that we're going to end this podcast with of things that you can be instead of an expert. Okay. And the first is to be a lifelong learner. Yes, be an inch deep and a mile wide. And I get that sometimes this phrase is kind of used dismissively to describe people who, you know, skip past the details or only read the headlines. But I think it's more reflective of how expansive the list of topics can be if you dedicate yourself to learning lifelong, lifelongingly. And I think that becoming a lifelong learner is a skill that pays in dividends because it allows you to kind of approach new topics with the same proficiency as you would a topic that you know a lot about. And with that proficiency, you gain competence. And with that competence, you gain confidence. So it's one of those things that has like compounding returns.
You sound like a
pastor.
I was going to say a combination between a pastor and lifelong learner.
King.
Every time I hear lifelong learner, I always think of like continuing education programs at universities.
That's what they call their students?
They call them lifelong learners.
Oh.
For the people who are adults that have gone back to sort of learn new skills, or at least the schools that I've been to, I've always seen like that, right?
Yeah.
Which, and again, it kind of proves the point. Like, you're never too old to learn something.
True.
And I, you know, we obviously take great pride in being lifelong learners. So I like that. I would also add that, like, being a role model.
Yes.
I think is a better bar than being an expert. And it's taken me a long time to get to that insight. But it's because, you know, when you're a role model, You're a trusted advisor for a certain group of people. You can wrap your arms around that group of people. Whereas when you're an expert, like, it's so expansive and all-encompassing. And, you know, that can be, like, uncomfortable or even intimidating. And you can be, like, a trusted advisor, like, to some people. Role model, sort of a similar term, and not others, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, these guys or these women come to me for counsel, but those people do not.
Right.
You know, and I think that's just a much better cloak or label to wear than expert. And, I just find it to be a bit more realistic and comfortable because expert, like, there's a weight to that.
There is.
You know, like, you've got
you have
to all,
be at the top of your game.
You can't say anything wrong because then your expertise may be called into question.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and so, like, that term, I think, is a bit troublesome because it gets in the way of people taking action. And even when they have gained a certain level of expertise, it gets in the way of them actually sharing it because it's a very uncomfortable term. Some people wear it comfortably, totally fine, but I find a lot of people find that to be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yes. Another thing you can be instead of an expert is to be a conversationalist. You know how they say that when you really understand something, you're able to explain it to other people? So if you are interested in learning about something deeply, take what you learn and talk about it with others.
Yeah.
Not only will it help you kind of spice up your social life, you'll also get a really good sense of where you're convicted in a belief or a topic, and where you might need a little more education or time with a concept because somebody threw you on your heels with an objection or a question, or someone else brought up a counterpoint about why that's not applicable to them. So focus on just being somebody who's comfortable talking about the subjects that you feel so passionate learning about.
I love that, because I also think it leads you to learning something new about the people you already know. And it also, I found, leads you to meeting people that you never, or right. leading and liking people that you would have never even thought
yes.
you could build a relationship with.
Yes.
And that is so critical to your first point around being a lifelong learner.
A learner lifelongingly.
The last one, because we're on a bit of a alliteration rant, is to be rich and regular.
Yes.
How about that?
Well played.
You know, I'm going to take a page from your not afraid to plug yourself shamelessly. But if you don't want to be an expert, you can just be rich and regular person. And again, there's so many layers to even that phrase. Obviously, it's one that we are passionate about because we own that brand and that trademark, by the way. But it's about like being comfortable with like average.
Yes.
You know, like being comfortable with that.
With
and obviously, even as an investor, you know, and which I think was one of the early thoughts around when we came up with that term. But, you know, if you're an average investor, like you're crushing it. You know what I mean? And there's value in that. You don't always have to find yourself in a position where you are chasing greater gains or above average, because there's a cost to doing that. You're accepting more risk. You are likely putting yourself in a position where you need to gain a greater level of expertise, which you may not have the comfort, the willingness, or the time, or even the resources to develop. That may lead to a whole bunch of frustration and so on and so on. So just like be comfortable with being rich and regular.
Yes.
You are comfortable with your investing strategy. It does not require a lot of time or thought. It puts you in a position where you are immune, if you will, to the flood of media and hype beasts that go out there, which leads to a better quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things, I think, are the benefits to like sort of being simple and leading your life that way. And the last thing I'll say is overall, I had this conversation with a couple of people already, but overall, I would love to see and push for a collective lowering of the bar.
Uh-huh.
I want to see less multimillion-dollar success stories, and I want to see more success stories of people who've paid off $5,000 in debt. Because
yes.
I remember being in those positions where that $5,000 felt impossible.
Yes,
you didn't know
like
where it was going to come from.
Exactly.
You didn't know what you could squeeze out of your life because you were already eating hot dogs and beans. I'm being specific here
mm-hmm.
because that was my go-to meal. And I just want to see more of that, because I think what's unfortunately happening is that we're becoming so extreme in these huge success stories that the genre as a whole is turning off the people who actually need this information
yes.
the most. And so I would love to see more lowering of the bar. Let's get back to the simpler, smaller,
yes.
you know. And again, I'm calling it small relative to where I am today, but like
right.
that $5,000 or $10,000 paid off, that's never going to make a headline. I'm just being yeah. honest. It's never going to make a headline, but that doesn't make the feat any less impressive. So
yes.
all of that to say, those are things that I'd love to see and that's celebrated, but more people kind of adopting as opposed to being an expert, being multi-millionaires, six-figure earners overnight, and all of those other fancy headlines that tend to dominate the media.
Well played. I love that. Let's move on to final thoughts.
Let's do it.
All right. So my final thought is, whenever you're living in a world that's full of information, applying constraints on your decision-making is actually one of the smartest things you can do. And that's the intent behind these don'ts. I know we've hedged a lot and gave you a lot of context and a lot of disclaimers, but the intent behind these don'ts is to add some constraints to your financial path. It's meant to be this filter for how you look at the infinite, literal infinite number of possibilities that are in front of you and reject a few of them off the top.
Yeah.
Whether you agree with our list or just want to come up with your own, I highly suggest you make a list of things that you just not gonna do.
I love it. Okay. My final thoughts are that money is complicated. And we're living in a period of like super hyper rapid change where a lot of information is available and being thrown at you all at once. And I think these days, your greatest weapon against that is simplicity. Mm-hmm. I think simplicity is so critical to your happiness. This is part of the reason why we get so many notes and emails from people. What should I do? Because I've got, I don't know what to do. I've got this opportunity, that opportunity. Should I move here? Should I invest in this? Should I trade this? Keep it simple. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, if you burn yourself out and if you don't find happiness throughout this process, it's going to lead to less healthy habits. It's going to lead to stress. And all of those things are going to have a negative impact on how consistent you are in wrapping your arms around whatever it is that you want to do that's going to ultimately help you achieve your financial goals. So focus on simplicity. What that looks like is likely going to be different for you than anyone else. But if you can do that, it will help you steer clear of what you shouldn't do. It'll help you steer and focus on the things that you should be doing. And that combination of the two is ultimately what's going to help you accomplish your goals.
Yes. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you stayed this long, here's a sixth don't, a bonus don't that sounds oddly like the first one. Don't leave us hanging. Head on over to the ratings and review page and leave us a 5-star review. We will see you next week.